Thank you. Hello, good morning, everybody. And thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very pleased to be here in Budapest. It's my first visit, and I'm enjoying it very much. I'm still trying to recover from the breakfast, which was so voluminous that if I'm a bit slow, you'll understand, perhaps. But anyway, I'm going to talk about the News of the World scandal from a constitutional perspective. I hope just to say something initially about what the whole thing was about and why it was important from a constitutional angle. I'm going to talk about the Leveson inquiry mainly from the point of view of its recommendations and how that impacted upon the regulatory position of the print media before and since this judicial inquiry. And at the end of my talk, I want to say something about the constitutional role of Parliament, because it was actually that role which got me interested in writing the chapter in the book, and I think I ought to say something about that at the end. So I hope that over the course of my talk, I'll give you some idea of the situation or the state of play in regard to press regulation in the UK. So if we just start off with the scandal, why was it a scandal? Why was it important? Well, basically, what it involved was the fact that the media were getting their hands on stories, very intimate stories, to do with celebrities, to do with even William and Kate, to do with murders where the victim had disappeared, all sorts of very sensitive matters. These stories were appearing in the press. There was no obvious explanation for this. And eventually, a Guardian journalist conducting an inquiry found out that this was being achieved by the systematic hacking of private mobile phones. Now, the point about this, as with any good scandal, it's not worth anything without a good cover-up. And we all remember with the Watergate affair, it was more the cover-up than the scandal. But you could say it's the same thing here, in a sense, because it's where the trail led, and it led in all sorts of directions, including up in one way to the Prime Minister and to, oh, well, I'm just showing you, we've got William and Kate's phone. We've got, this is a murder victim whose mobile phone had been tapped, so her parents thought that she was still alive. We have the editor of the News of the World when all of this was happening, who was then appointed as Cameron's press secretary. And so the Prime Minister's own secretary, press secretary, went all the way to Downing Street in a kind of way. And then, of course, we have the media and the executives in the media and their association. And this is Rebecca Brooks, who was in charge of the News of the World, and Mr. Murdoch himself. And then we had the resignation of the Metropolitan Police Commissioner because of the failure of the police to investigate in the way that they should have done. The ultimate expression was the judicial inquiry under Lord Justice Leveson, which is a very voluminous inquiry which looks into the media in with great thoroughness, over 1,000 pages, which I'm summarising in a couple of lines, of course. But what I now want to do is to explain why this is significant as far as media regulation is concerned. And everybody says to me, I mean, wherever I travel, when the further you travel, well, how do you teach constitutional law since you don't have a constitution? Of course, we do in the United Kingdom, believe it or not, have a constitution, and Magna Carta, as we've just said, could be said to be very pertinent to it. But what we don't have is a codified or written constitution. We have many statements about the importance of free speech. And one of those statements, famous one by Sir John Donaldson in the Spycatcher case, Attorney General and Guardian newspapers, illustrates how important free speech is in a democracy. But translated into practice, as far as the press is concerned, one of the things that's characteristic of the UK system is the fact that we've never believed or tried to minimise prior restraint, as far as the media is concerned, to prevent them actually publishing. So that the general situation was that the media were free to publish and be damned, as it were. An injunction would be needed by government to intervene. Of course, the Human Rights Act, for the first time, gives a positive endorsement of freedom of speech, as it's indirectly incorporated the European Convention. And this is set against a background of when we talk about free speech, as our previous speaker has made clear, free has to be taken with a big pinch of salt, given the fact that the ownership or the institutional position of the media is obviously something which can be called into question when we talk about how the actual whole thing operates. But the statutory restrictions are limited to things like Official Secrets Act and Freedom of Information Act and so on. So when Leveson was called in to look into this inquiry, what he was doing, I'm trying to work out how this clock works, because I'm not clear. I see how it works now. So when we're looking at Leveson, he had quite a big terms of reference in what he was allowed to look at, but it was very much to do with the print media. And the reason for the Leveson inquiry was political, I would say, probably to divert attention away from the politicians and also to the scandal that was brewing. But it inevitably led to the issue of press regulation. And that's where I want to just say something about next, because the idea of regulating the press, governments have always been very reluctant to go down this path. And if we look at the previous attempt going back to the 1990s, and I've got a quote from a select committee report here from Parliament, we can see that there was a great reluctance to see active legislation imposing itself on the activities of the press. And as a result, we got a new regulatory body called the Press Complaints Commission, which comprised of representatives nominated by the press and essentially had no powers. Leveson was dismissive of this body. He said the fundamental problem is that the Press Complaints Committee is not a regulator at all. In reality, it's a complaints handling body and not a very good one at that. So a new self-regulating body was recommended, as we'll see. Now, if we look at the abuse that preceded this whole process, we can see that there are many types of shortcomings that had to be addressed. Critical questions were asked of things like the Metropolitan Police because there had been inadequate criminal investigation of criminal wrongdoing. So we're not talking here about regulation in a sort of general sense of looking at or prior restraint of article. There was actual accusations and evidence of criminal wrongdoing. And of course, this concentrated media ownership issue manifested itself in all sorts of ways because of the insidiousness of the relationships that existed between these figures, between Coulson and Rebecca Brooks and Murdoch and senior politicians and policemen. And the other thing, which of course I just want to end with when I end my talk, is about the role of Parliament in being able to unearth all of this at the end of the day. But going to look at what Lord Justice Leveson recommended, he wanted to see a much more independent type of body. He wanted to see a new code of practice, and his basic suggestion was that the, I think the quote, quoting his words, real harm caused to real people by privacy invading expression should be the criteria for looking into whether the press had actually gone over the top in the way that they were acting. He also suggested that the new body should be funded by the media with an agreement to have a new regulator which the media in general accepted, and the new regulator should have some real teeth. Now, this, of course, was something that the Press Complaints Commission, the previous regulator, didn't have at all in being able to get apologies, which were given prominence in the press, and also to impose sanctions, considerable sanctions, against the media. And the idea of whistleblowing hotlines so that if there was a repetition by press owners of this kind of abuse that had been sanctioned in the past, there would be an avenue for whistleblowers to be able to expose it without exposing themselves personally. So, and the other thing that the newspapers would be required to do was to publish compliance reports. So what we had after the Press Complaints Commission was a disagreement between the political parties. And although David Cameron had said in the past that he would take the recommendations and recommend them in full, and take them forward in full, in fact, the whole thing was watered down. And the media actually came up, or the newspapers, the main newspaper owners, came up with their own new regulatory body, which was set up very recently. And quite surprisingly, it had at its helm a former distinguished judge, Lord Justice Moses. And it certainly, as a body, I'm just giving you some factual information about it here, as a body, was better set up in a better way than the previous one, with a different code of practice issued by the body. Rulings which were taken up by the body are now published on its website. But this body did not, in fundamental respects, reflect the Leveson proposals. It fell short in terms of who was recommended, in terms of its ability to impose remedies, and so on. And it's quite interesting that we now have a kind of disapproved, a baddie regulator, and a goodie regulator, in the sense that, as a result of that, some people associated with publishing generally put up some money for a second regulatory body to be introduced, which is called the Independent Monitor of the Press, IMPRESS. And this body was designed to be much more robust than the previous body that I've just mentioned. The trouble is that this isn't fully up and running, and it's not fully funded. But this body was set to encourage the highest standards following the Leveson criteria, and it was to have a much more thorough complaint handling function, which included being able to conduct own initiative investigations. It's particularly interesting, looking at this retrospectively, that the Press Complaints Commission manifestly failed to follow up when there were the original Hackgate accusations in regard to these terrible abuses that I mentioned right at the beginning of my talk. And also, the IMPRESS will have a whistleblower's hotline, and it is meant to appeal to journalists who value integrity and independence. So we have two contrasting types of body, and it's quite interesting that some of the important newspapers, the Financial Times and the Guardian, have not signed up to the previous, the IPCRO regulator. So we have a situation where this is the position as far as the regulation is concerned at the moment. We have two bodies instead of one. The body that's been set up is certainly better than the previous one, but it falls far short of the Leveson criteria, and this one hasn't yet been fully taken up. So what I'm saying is sort of somewhat provisional. Now, I've kind of got to where I wanted to at this point, because I wanted to go back to why I got involved in writing the paper, because the interesting thing for me was that from a constitutional point of view, we'd reached a situation where these abuses had taken place, the regulatory machinery had manifestly failed, there had been a lot of people upset as a result, and nothing appeared to be happening, except that these departmental select committees, and it's, people don't often recognise, I think, the importance of these committees, were responsible for blowing this out into the open by the questioning that they conducted. The committees that were responsible for culture, media and sport and for home affairs called before them as witnesses many of the main players in the scandal that had been uncovered. And it was because of their capacity to call these witnesses and put them in front of the television cameras and ask difficult questions of them. In fact, during one of the hearings, which was actually a questioning of Rupert Murdoch, the biggest news was because a member of the public gallery showered him with shaving foam, which was kind of front page news. But I think that's slightly ironic in a way, because actually the committee questioning had a major impact. But it also led directly to the fact that the newspaper, the News of the World itself, was closed. It was closed down. It was also interesting that these committees acted together. We had a situation where the committee which reflects or shadows the Ministry of Culture, Media and Sport dealt with Murdoch and the Murdoch press and the people, the journalist and the journalistic angle, whereas the Home Affairs Committee, which deals with policing and that sort of thing, dealt with the Metropolitan Police and their association with the media. And there were other committees involved as well. There were committees of the House of Lords and others who were able to bring in experts and others, which led to the setting up of eventually of the Leveson inquiry that we've talked about in my presentation. So the last thing that I just mentioned here is that there was, as and there is, because of the nature of these committees which have this investigatory role, these committees are not responsible for legislation, they're responsible for keeping a check on the executive, and there is a kind of dialogue because their reports are responded to by government. And so the kind of dialogue that takes place between them is particularly interesting. Now, they have parallels with the US congressional committees. Now, I just wanted to say, finally, in the last couple of minutes, not just to quote from the reports, but in my conclusion, I want to say something which kind of goes back to what other speakers have said already today, that there is a certain irony to all this, because the exposure of the original scandal was triggered by a journalist. So the whole thing was set off by a journalist, which illustrates that the capacity of a free press to dig deep and investigate the practices within the press itself was of essential value. If we'd had an overly protected privacy law, and the case law in the United Kingdom has moved towards privacy, maybe too far towards privacy, supported by an intrusive or over-intrusive regulatory body, this might have inhibited the process which had exposed this scandal. So, in a sense, the scandal illustrates how important it is not to have too high a profile regulation. But having said this, I still believe, looking at it from a constitutional and institutional point of view, that the new regulatory body has too much in common with the previous one and isn't strong enough at the moment. I just leave you with the final point that it was the parliamentary mechanisms that was able to really blow this up into the open. Thank you very much for listening to me.